This week on Behind the Lens, shrinking the Gulf Coast dead zone, how nutrients from industrial farms in the Midwest are affecting the Gulf, impacting the fishing industry, and what can be done to fix it. Reporter Spike Johnson has the story. And the Industrial Tax Exemption Program. The Orleans Parish Assessor's Office vows to conduct a review of its records in order to verify millions of dollars worth of corporate property tax breaks. Michael Isaac Stein explains. Also, I'll talk to Fair Elections Crusader, Democrat Stacey Abrams, about her fight against voter suppression in 2020 and why she has an eye on Louisiana's fall gubernatorial election. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
The Mississippi River drains 41% of the country's water into the Delta, and that water carries contaminants. Runoff from farms in the Midwest contains nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers, which have collected in the Gulf of Mexico and created an area of depleted oxygen, or a dead zone. Reporter Spike Johnson spoke to Midwest farmers and Gulf fishermen about how what happens upriver affects those of us downriver. Spike, you did some reporting on how farmers in the United States are trying to address so-called dead zones. So for listeners who don't know, explain to us what a dead zone is and how it happens.
Sure. A dead zone is an area of ocean that has not enough oxygen for fish and shellfish and other sea life to survive anymore. So it's also called a hypoxic zone, hypoxic dead zone.
And how do those form?
They form from a buildup of agricultural pollutants and also industrial pollutants as well, which congregate, I suppose, or concentrate in areas of ocean off, you know, mainland, large continental mainland. And they promote the growth of algae and other microscopic organisms, which suck up the oxygen faster than the fish can, basically.
And we have this dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico from nutrients that flow down the Mississippi River. And scientists measure it from one year to the next to kind of keep track of how large or small it might be. And ultimately, what's the danger of these dead zones? Why is this a bad thing?
Immediately, it's not a bad thing for human existence, if you like. But what it is doing is it's, in the US, it's really hurting our fishing industries down in Louisiana, particularly, and off the Texas coast. They're really struggling. They're having to travel a lot further out to sea to find, you know, their shrimp and a lot of their oysters because the shellfish can't escape the dead zone. You know, they don't have fins. They attach themselves to the bottom of the ocean, and if their oxygen depletes, they perish where they lay, as it were. So fisheries are impacted. Long-term species migration is impacted, and the ability of fish and shellfish and shrimp to spawn is affected, because often these species come in towards the shore into the shallower waters to spawn, but increasingly they can't get to those spawning grounds because this dead zone, which is, you know, thousands of square miles, is in their way, so they can't get around it to come back in to spawn. So their populations are beginning to dwindle. Overall, the size of each individual fish is falling over time because they're not reaching maturity across the board as they were in decades past.
And as you explained, this dead zone develops because of an increase in nutrients that suck up the oxygen out of the water. And that all comes down the river in the form of fertilizers and various other things from up north. How have changes in farming over the years added to this dead zone problem?
Well, we're using more fertilizer than we did before. We're using nitrate fertilizer and phosphate fertilizer, two different types, but they both have the same effect in the oceans when they get to the oceans. We're using less natural fertilizer. So before, when we'd have diverse farms that would have, you know, some livestock on them from a little bit of dairy, and also farmers would keep grazing cattle, and they'd also grow crops, so they'd be kind of farming using multiple disciplines. and then fertilizing their land with cattle waste, you know, poop from the cattle. But now we specialize, now our farmers specialize in one crop or two crops. So what we're getting is hundreds of thousands of acres of corn and or soybean just rotated back and forth in fields. So over time, the soil health is declining, requiring more fertilizer. There's also the issue that farmers are plowing their fields too much. So they're tilling their fields until they're really susceptible to erosion and to runoff. So when heavy rains come, which and we're seeing heavier and heavier rains every year, which are washing, you know, the top layer of soil off, which is holding the leftover fertilizer from the previous crop. And then it goes straight into the waterways and then, you know, runs down to the Gulf of Mexico.
I think that's really particularly interesting, is this, you know, confluence of all of these things coming together between what the farmers are farming, the way they're farming it, and then these environmental changes. And, you know, as with everything dealing with the environment, there's a ripple effect. And you spoke to a shrimper who's experiencing the effects of what's happening upriver down in the Gulf of Mexico. Who did you talk to, and what did he have to say?
Oh, I spoke to a few. I spoke to a lady as well called Kim Chauvin, and I spoke to Dean Blanchard, Dean is, I think, one of the largest distributors of shrimp in the US. And Kim is up there as well. They both work out of Louisiana, Grand Isle area, so around the Atchafalaya and the mouth of the Mississippi itself. They're pretty angry people. They're, you know, they're still reeling from the BP oil spill, but every year they mention that their productivity drops in terms of the shrimp that they're able to land, because the shrimpers that deliver to them, you know, just aren't catching as much. They're having to travel further. They're spending more on diesel to get out to the shrimp. The shrimp are not as predictable as they used to be, so their sizes vary a lot now, and their migratory patterns vary a lot now. The shrimpers down there themselves, they're very outspoken. They're pretty angry, and they want to sit down with the EPA and the USDA and Congress and try and figure out a way that both of these industries can work together, because at the moment, you know, large-scale agriculture is hurting the fishing industry, and they want fines and they want regulation. So they're kind of taking a hardline approach. They're not upset with small-scale farmers, though. They are conversationally targeting large-scale corn farms. They have a view that the small mom-and-pop farms are the ones that are implementing, you know, cover crops and nutrient reduction strategies like we speak about in the article. But the view of the shrimpers down in Louisiana is that the industrial farms aren't doing enough or anything to mitigate their nutrient loss.
Is there a solution to be struck between farmers and fishermen? Do you think that there is, I don't know, a compromise that everybody might be almost happy?
Yeah, I think so. But it's going to take a long time. The compromise is that some of these nutrient reduction strategies are long-term financially beneficial to agriculture. So what needs to happen is the large-scale industrial farms need to be convinced that these methods of nutrient reduction over time, on balance, will be beneficial to them financially, and also will be beneficial to, you know, fish species down there in the Gulf, and will also be beneficial to the shrimping industry, for example. At the moment, they're just kind of slow to be adopting the nutrient reduction strategies that the smaller farmers have been experimenting with. You know, so the smaller farmers are finding that when they run cover crops on their fields, and cover crops are an alternative crop, so like a small grain like rye or cereal or barley or something like that, that they sow into harvested corn or soybean stalks. So there's no ploughing of the field, there's no tilling of the soil or anything like that. And then the field is never devoid of crop. So there's no erosion when the heavy rains come, and the roots aerate the soil well, so that when rains do come, they don't just wash straight off the top, they go down into the land. They promote earthworm activity, so for better soil health there. And in the end, they decay and depose, and they put carbon and, you know, other minerals and molecules back into the soil. Then when time for planting corn and soybean comes around, the next year's primary crop benefits again from those minerals. So although on an annual basis they have to pay for the use of an airplane to sow their cover crops, and they have to pay for seed, after 5 years they're beginning to make that money back because their soil is much healthier and they're seeing increased growth in their primary crop, and they can use less fertilizer, which saves them money. So it's in an experimental phase, but hopefully down the line large-scale industry will see what's happening there and will begin to adopt the same practices.
That was Spike Johnson reporting for The Lens. The Industrial Tax Exemption Program provides property tax breaks to corporations in exchange for business investment in the state. It's a somewhat controversial program, costing parishes millions of dollars in tax revenue every year, but widely seen as necessary to make Louisiana more attractive to corporate investors. The Orleans Parish Assessor is tasked with running the program in Orleans Parish, which recently came under scrutiny from the New Orleans City Council. Michael Isaac Stein is here with that story. Michael, for those who don't know, let's start by explaining what ITEP is.
ITEP is the Industrial Tax Exemption Program. It's a state-level tax subsidy that is known for being extremely generous. It costs about $1 billion a year, and most of that is revenue that's lost to local and parish level governments. And, you know, one of the big critiques all along has been that while it's local and parish governments who take the revenue hit, it's the state that's in charge. And basically how the exemptions work, it's basically meant to encourage more manufacturing jobs. And so a company will be, you know, that's already here will say, hey, I want to expand our operations. I want to invest in this property. You can apply to have that entire investment exempted from your property taxes for an initial term of 5 years, and then you can apply for another 5 years. Now, for a long time, for decades, that's been an almost automatic process. There's almost a 100% approval rate. The program has come under a lot of fire in the past few years for basically, number one, depriving a lot of tax revenue from, you know, parishes and cities that really need the money. And second of all, there was some great reporting out of The Advocate about how after some of these companies got the exemptions, they were cutting jobs left and right. So, you know, the state as a whole has been losing manufacturing jobs like crazy, and it just doesn't seem like the ITEP exemptions were ever really encouraging businesses to keep those jobs on or add more. So there have been changes. In 2018, the rules changed to give local governments more control. So now our city council has some veto power after the state approves one of these exemptions.
You know, there's definitely a balance between trying to encourage business development and investment and also, you know, get tax revenue for parishes. And in that sense, it is the responsibility of the Orleans Parish Assessor's Office to track these tax exemptions, and they don't last forever.
Right. So one thing I should note at the top, this story is not so much a question of whether ITEP is a good program or not, whether these exemptions should have been granted. It's simply a story of whether the exemptions are being properly applied to taxes. And so that's basically the assessor's job. The assessor's job is to keep track of property values in the city of New Orleans, keep track of business personal property, and set the tax accordingly. So basically, he has to track these exemptions and end them when that's appropriate.
And to that end, there was a meeting recently of a property tax oversight committee, and the advocacy group Together New Orleans was there. They claimed that there are a handful of these ITEP exemptions that are on the rolls but have expired.
Right. So actually, they were giving a presentation actually on what we've talked about before, which is the rapidly rising property taxes for a lot of residential homes in the city. Now, they use that opportunity to point out that, you know, while the city is poised to collect a lot more money from residents, there might just be millions sitting on the table from corporations in Orleans Parish that should be collected but aren't. So they're basically claiming that the assessor has allowed exemptions to remain in place farther than they've been approved for.
So Together New Orleans made this claim, and what did Errol Williams, the Orleans Parish assessor, have to say about it?
The Times-Picayune / the New Orleans Advocate reported that he says that all of his records are current.
So a few people took issue with that and looked into it. Who looked into it and what did everybody find?
Yeah, so there's been a real focus on actually two of these exemptions for Folgers, the coffee company. They have two properties in New Orleans, and they actually have several ITEP exemptions. But in particular, there were two that have actually been a topic of discussion for months now. Basically, they were approved in 2012. The combined value was for $40 million. That's what the exemption was for. They were approved for an initial period of 2012 to 2017. Since 2017, in 2018 and 2019, that $40 million remained exempt. So for the past few months, council member Helena Moreno's office, the organization Together New Orleans, the Advocate, as well as the Lens, have approached the assessor, Errol Williams, about these two contracts. And you know, all summer he, you know, was maintaining that those contracts would be maintained until 2021. So basically here he was under the impression that those two exemptions had been extended for another 5 years, even though they had not.
So what's at the bottom of this? It seems like it's just poor bookkeeping at the level of the assessor's office.
Yeah. So we talked to the assessor, and basically his office has a policy of always assuming that industrial tax exemptions will be extended for the full 10 years. So whether or not he gets notification that a renewal application was approved, he's going to keep that exemption on the rolls until he gets a notification that the renewal application was denied. Now, that becomes a problem for a couple of reasons. I mean, in fairness to the assessor, like we said, these applications are approved almost automatically, but there are still situations where they're not. You know, like we said, there's been changes in the past few years that have made it a little bit harder. Now, you know, local governments now have say, which adds a new barrier to approval. You know, and there's also the issue of if a company never applies for the renewal, they would never get a notification that the renewal was denied, and then we're at a risk of continuing the exemption for a full 10 years, even though there was no renewal application ever even submitted. And it raises questions about how the assessor's office is tracking the several other industrial tax exemptions that currently exist in Orleans Parish.
This one's kind of tough because it's a program that's controversial enough. It is a situation where the city stands to be losing tax revenue from businesses at the same time where residents feel pretty upset that their taxes are going up.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, on top of that, talking to the chairman of the Louisiana Tax Commission, which kind of monitors the work of local assessors, he basically described to the Lens that the process should be different, that if an assessor does not get confirmation of a renewal, then they should take that exemption off the rolls. Or, you know, they can reach out to the Louisiana Department of Economic Development, which is kind of administers this program, and find out for themselves. And I think, you know, the assessor's office now is taking more of a passive approach where the default is continuing the exemption.
A passive approach that requires a little less administrative work, but might be costing the city millions of dollars.
Yeah, well, and two things on the assessor, Errol Williams maintains that the city has not lost any money because of this. You know, for example, when we take these two Folgers contracts, he has since determined that indeed those exemptions did expire in 2017. And so now he's going to put those on the rolls in 2020, and he's also going to go back and collect the uncollected taxes from 2018 and 2019. So he's saying the city is not losing any money. You know, we should also note that we did make an attempt to try and check whether the exemptions were being taken away in a timely and proper manner. Based off of public documents, it's nearly impossible to tell, according to the assessor, to really confirm that all of these exempted properties are being, you know, put back on the tax rolls, you would need to get the company's business tax returns, which is not a public record and not something that's easy to get your hands on. So at the end of the day, we really don't know, but there appear to be flaws in the way that these exemptions are tracked that could lead to the city losing money.
Michael Isaacstein, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
In 2018, Democrat Stacey Abrams narrowly lost a race for governor in Georgia and sued the State Board of Elections, citing widespread allegations of voter suppression. Abrams has since founded the group Fair Fight 2020 to advocate for free and fair elections. I spoke with Stacey Abrams by phone on Tuesday, which happened to be the same day that North Carolina was holding a special election because of evidence of fraud in a 2018 midterm race. You recently announced the Fair Fight 2020 initiative. Briefly explain for me what that is.
Fair Fight 2020 is a 20-state initiative that will set up and support voter protection teams in the battleground states for 2019 and 2020. That means we will fund, train, and staff folks who will lead voter protection in each of these states.
How will the program be run, and where is the funding come from? I understand you are looking to invest between $4 and $5 million in this effort.
We have identified 20 battleground states based on the 2019 states that have statewide elections, so Louisiana, Mississippi, and Kentucky. And then the remaining 17 states are battleground states for the presidency, for Senate races, and for down ballot races, including secretaries of state, attorneys general, or states where we could flip one of the chambers, either the House or the Senate, so that there's more influence over redistricting. The role that we will play is that we are working in concert with state parties. We are helping to invest. We will actually help them hire full-time staff at a minimum of 4. We will help train that staff, and we will make certain that that staff has access to resources to provide voter protection support in that state. The role that I play, the role that Fair Fight 2020 plays, is that we are raising the money ourselves. We are going to be the providers of those funds, roughly $4 to $5 million, that will be used to hire, to train, and to secure full-time employment for staffers.
And specifically, what areas are you targeting to raise this money?
I'm reaching out across the country. We are talking to those who've demonstrated an interest in voter protection, those who have been supportive of the work I've done, both as Democratic leader and as a candidate for governor, investors who've been supportive of the Fair Fight work that we've been doing since our election, and any person of goodwill. We've had extraordinary responses from individual donors who've gone to fairfight2020.org and made contributions as small as $5, because I think what's resonating is that people understand that voter protection is the basis for all of the other policies we want to see enacted. That if your issue is climate change, if it's criminal justice reform, if it's education or healthcare, if we do not have the right to vote, if that right is not protected in these battleground states, then that right is not real.
You've mentioned most of the states that you've chosen are battleground states. Why do you see Louisiana as a battleground state?
Well, first of all, I am a daughter of the Deep South. I grew up in Mississippi, on the coast next door to Louisiana. But more importantly, I understand what Louisiana has meant to the South. It is one of the few southern states that expanded Medicaid, and it did so under a Democratic governor. We know that the election of leaders who share progressive values can change the future of a state. And so when this year's election came up, when we thought about where should we go, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Kentucky are the three states that have statewide elections, and those are three states that have demonstrated in different ways the importance that they can play in the future of the country. Louisiana in particular, because of the work that's been done, not only on the issue of healthcare expansion, but on the issue of criminal justice reform, felony reenfranchisement. We are in Louisiana because I know how important the Deep South is, and I refuse to walk away because it hasn't proven itself in the ways that some people expect to see. But I know how far Louisiana has come, and I know how much more it can accomplish.
And those issues that you mentioned, felony reinstatement of voting privileges and Medicaid expansion happened under a conservative Democratic governor. Are you partisanly pushing a change in the state then?
Fair Fight 2020 is a decidedly partisan endeavor. We are working with state parties, in part because we know that most of the recent voter suppression activity has come from the Republican Party. And the ability to have the kind of breadth and depth of effect that we want to have on voter suppression means you need to be situated in the organisms that are designed for that work, and state parties are. So we are working very closely with the Louisiana Democratic Party's voter protection efforts in advance of the October 12th election. We know how important it was that John Bel Edwards' election in 2017 changed the way the state operated. And we know that by being in place and doing this work, we can assist in ensuring that good continues to happen. I vehemently disagree with Governor Bel Edwards on the issue of reproductive freedom. I think that he is absolutely wrong about his decision to support that legislation. But I support the work that's been done to expand access to health care, the work that's been done on criminal justice reform. And when given my druthers, I would much rather have John Bel Edwards and, more importantly, have legislative leaders who are preparing to help turn the tide in the state of Louisiana.
On the issue of voter oppression or voter suppression in Louisiana, Louisiana is, in southern states, kind of above the fray in terms of a lot of these voter oppression issues. We don't have strict voter ID laws. The state actually hasn't enacted new voting restrictions in the past 8 years, though it does purge its voter rolls after a number of years if a home address can't be confirmed. That's a multi-step process. Is there something specifically that concerns you about voter suppression in Louisiana, and what's your position on purging voter rolls?
Well, one of the goals of Fair Fight 2020 is to look at each state that is considered a battleground state, or again, in the question of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Kentucky, looking at states that have competitive races this year where voter suppression may emerge. We wanted to help those states identify priorities for their 2019 programs, and our funding will help them hire someone to execute those plans. And so we are working with the Louisiana Democratic Party to identify any concerns they have. We know that, for example, in Nevada, they've just passed a raft of very progressive rules about protecting the right to vote. But part of the challenge is making sure that everyone is properly supporting and enforcing those new rights. And in Louisiana, we want to be there, not just because there's a problem, but in anticipation of need. Purging voters for inaction or inactivity, I think, is deeply problematic unless it's directly tied to making certain that person is no longer eligible to vote because of death, because of moving, because of a loss of their right to vote. The challenge I have with purging voters is that in recent years, it has been used to remove people simply for failure to vote. We do not require mandatory voting in the United States, and therefore people who are otherwise eligible should not lose their right to vote in their state as long as it is their choice not to vote. The notion of voter purges began with the idea of keeping the rolls clean, making sure that the dead don't vote, and I completely support that, making certain that those who no longer live in a state don't try to vote in two states. That actually is almost unheard of. But what has happened is that they have weaponized this purging process, and by doing so, they have removed valid voters from the rolls. We know that's happened in Georgia. We know that's happened across the country. I can't speak to what's happened in Louisiana, but we want to be on the ground in case anyone is mistakenly purged and needs access to information about how to be restored or any other form of voter suppression. We want to be there not just to fight back against what's been done wrong, but to help make certain people know what their rights are.
And, you know, we also mentioned briefly that Louisiana has reinstated voting privileges for ex-felons. Is your organization going to provide some resources to making sure that that process runs smoothly? Because if I remember correctly, it's a bit of a cumbersome process.
Well, we know that the Louisiana Democratic Party is looking at how they can be of assistance in ensuring that people who have newly restored rights have access to those rights. And so, yes, some of the investment that we're making will support the party's work to ensure that voters who have rights and aren't aware of them or who are having difficulty navigating that process have the support they need. But I want to be very clear. a big part of our approach is that we provide resources and training and support, but that we also recognize the primacy of the state leaders to lead the conversation. We are not coming from Georgia saying, here's what you must do in Louisiana. What we're saying is that we care about the nation, and we're going to put our money where our mouths are. We're not just going to talk about fighting for voter protection. We're going to invest in helping each state make voter protection real where they live.
Okay. And my final question, when voter ID laws are passed, proponents across the country are claiming that it's to prevent voter fraud. Which has proven to be the bigger issue in the country, voter fraud or voter suppression?
Voter suppression is by far not only the predominant challenge, it is the only real proven challenge. Most issues of voter fraud actually tend to be voter mistakes, people who did not understand the rules. We are a nation that has 50 different laws for democracy. Depending on the state you live in, the rules are completely different. And within that, we have 3,100 different administrative departments, our counties and parishes. The reality is most accusations of voter fraud turn out to be voter mistake and voter error. We don't have people who are trying to impersonate someone or who are putting on a hat and a funny mustache so they can vote twice. America doesn't have an overvoter problem. We have a problem with getting enough people to show up and speak, and part of that is because voter suppression is real. But as the Trump administration has proven not once but twice now, being able to provide any degree of proof for voter fraud as a scourge has been impossible. It is less than 1%, and in fact, I think the most recent numbers I saw are it's 0.000 and then add a number. But it is almost non-existent, and it is mythological in its effect, but it is not real in its actuality.
Stacey Abrams, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, and I encourage everyone to go to fairfight2020.org for more information.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next Friday. And please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.